This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year's Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film and the Golden Globe for Best Foreign Film went to the Danish movie In a Better World. The film begins opening in U.S. theaters April 1st. My guest is the film's director, Susanna Beer. Her other movies include After the Wedding and Brothers, which was remade into an American film starring Tobey Maguire, Jake Gyllenhaal, and Natalie Portman. She made one English language film, Things We Lost in the Fire. For one of Beer's films, she followed the Dogma Manifesto that was written in 1995 by the Danish directors Lars von Trier and Thomas Vinterberg, creating a set of rules for making movies without embellishments like props and special effects. Beer's new film, In a Better World, is set in Denmark and Africa. One of the characters it follows is a doctor who lives in Denmark but works part of each year in a medical clinic at an African refugee camp where some of his patients are the victims of a warlord's sadistic acts of violence. The doctor is so caught up in his work, he doesn't comprehend how his son's life is being dramatically altered by the boys who have been bullying him at school. The new student, who becomes his protector, is out for revenge and may be more dangerous than the bullies. Susanna Beer, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on your Oscar and your Golden Globe.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, your new movie, In a Better World, compares acts of revenge and violence and the difficulty of finding forgiveness in an African war zone and at home where children are bullying each other and where adults are bullying each other. What made you think about that comparison between bullying at home and acts of, you know, really sadistic violence in an African war zone?
I guess that the whole point was to sort of communicate that the standards of living or the conditions of living in Africa, like in a refugee camp in Africa and in a privileged town or part of Denmark, couldn't be more different. But the actual human nature is so similar. So it's kind of like, in a way, showing the same story but in two different shapes.
Now, in the African refugee camp, there are some monstrous crimes being committed. In fact, if you're listening with a child now, you might want to just tune out for a few seconds because I'm going to describe one of the crimes. There's a warlord, the big man, who bets on pregnant women, on whether they're carrying a boy or a girl. And in order to see if he's right and if he's won his bet, he slits them open. And the doctor in your movie, the doctor from Denmark who works in a, I imagine in a Doctors Without Borders kind of organization and who works in this refugee camp, sometimes has to try to save a pregnant woman who is in this position and who is slit open. Have you heard of such a crime? Is this based on something?
Actually, it's actually based on a real story that we did talk a lot with Doctors Without Borders, and this one doctor told me that she had encountered a patient coming in who was a known warlord, and all the people at a refugee camp were terrified of him, and he was known to do this. He was known to take around gangs of young guys and bet as to whether the sex of the infant in the womb was a boy or a girl. And in most cases, both the infant and the mother would die because it's very, very hard to save them. And she was faced with that sort of, he'd been hurt in an accident, should she save him or should she not save him? And eventually he disappeared. But it was just such an interesting story, and it's one of the few stories which is actually built on a real thing in the movie.
Yes, and in your movie, the doctor in the movie has to decide when the big man comes to him with a horrible leg wound whether the doctor's going to try to save him or not. And I won't give away what happens with that. Meanwhile, back at home in Denmark, the son of the doctor, who's probably around 12, is being bullied at school because he appears wimpy and he's from Sweden, not Denmark, so he's called a Swede, an ugly mutant. And here you have, you know, it's kids in a middle-class school, And to an American, there's not a huge difference between a Swede and somebody from Denmark. You know that.
Not to us either.
Yeah.
That's actually one of the points is that it's also kind of a point about racism. It's also showing how stupid racism is because, I mean, Swedes and Danes are very, I mean, couldn't be more similar. So it's also kind of pointing at how idiotic racism is in its core.
But even in marriage, there are problems within marriages in your movie, too. Even people who love each other are having trouble getting along.
Yes. The boy that you are mentioning, Elias, is a son of a doctor, and his mother is, in fact, also a doctor. And the parents are separating because of his infidelity. And he's being bullied at school because he's insecure and not like a really forceful boy.
Now, the doctor who works at the African refugee camp part-time, he's risking his life to save lives. He's really a hero at work. But at home, he's separating from his wife. He's really not there for his son, and his son really misses him and at points in this movie desperately needs his father to be there. Do you think that some people who are really quite heroic in their work have a home life that's falling apart because of it? They're really not quite a hero at home?
I think it's extremely difficult consistently being a decent human being. And I think what he does in Africa is undeniable, resourceful and heroic. I don't think he's got no ill will at home. It's not as if he doesn't care. I think there is probably a level to a human's capacity. And in that case, probably he is not there enough for his son. But I think the movie clearly does not judge him, and nor do I. I just think it's, you know, probably the case, and I think probably many of us can look at our own life and recognize that we might be incredibly resourceful in certain areas and less so in other areas, and that's, I think, modern lives have so many demands on us, and we can't fulfill them all.
In Denmark, where your film was initially released, the title translates to revenge. In America, the film has been titled In a Better World. Does that say something about the difference between movies in Denmark and movies in America?
Actually, it just says something about my timing, because I was never really happy with the title Revenge. But by the time I caught on to the title In a Better World, which I much prefer, it was too late to change the Danish title. I feel that In a Better World point towards the hopefulness of the film, whereas Revenge points towards the severeness. And I prefer emphasizing the hopefulness.
Now, I've seen two of your films that deal with war, and Brothers and In a Better World. Can you talk about how war has figured into your family life?
I mean, none of my movies are autobiographical. It's not as if I have personally experienced war. I'm Jewish, and my family is Jewish, and I think that I've always had a very distinct recognition of war being a possibility, of imminent catastrophe being a possible real thing. And therefore, I think in a way it's been very natural for me to place some of my movies in a warlike situations.
Now, I know that your family had to flee Denmark after the Nazi invasion. Correct me if I'm getting any of this wrong.
It's in 43. They invaded earlier than that, but yes, you're right.
And they had fled to Denmark from other places. So what brought your family to Denmark in the first place?
Well, I mean, Denmark has always been known to be, they had very, very early, like I think already in like the 16th century, they had laws which were permitting Jews to live there, and they were always pretty friendly to strangers. So my mother's family came after the pogrom in Russia, and my father's family came when Hitler reached power in 1933. They came to Denmark.
Your father was living in Germany.
Their family was living in Berlin. Yes,
mm-hmm.
And then they had to escape. But in 43, the Jews in Denmark were not being taken to concentration camp for a long, long time. Denmark was invaded, but for a long time they were allowed to live there. And then in 43, the Germans decided to capture the Jews and take them into concentration camp. But most of them escaped because they were warned by the Danish government, and they managed to escape to Sweden.
How? How did your family escape?
Well, they most of them, there's a very narrow sea between Sweden and Denmark, and most of them were taken by sailors or even by small rowing boats, were crossing the sea, and it's a pretty heroic part of Danish history, because actually there were many, many families that were helping the Jewish families, and my Jewish family. Where my grandparents were still alive until very recently, had maintained very, very close contact with the family that helped them during the war.
So how old were you when your parents or grandparents started telling you this story? And how did they color it? Did they tell it to you in a frightening way or in as neutral a way as possible so as not to scare you too much?
Look, stories are only boring if they are neutral. And I think that any parents would try and tell stories in a sort of, possibly not in a threatening way, but in a dramatic way. And actually, both of my parents' stories very individually stayed with me. My father's story was that they were taking first, he was, for the first time in his life, his father was, my father's father was a very stoic and very sort of aristocratic gentleman, and he did not particularly deal with his kids. But for the first time in his life, my father was being collected at school by his father, and that was because they had to escape. And they were then hiding in a somewhere in the countryside, and then they were taken by car to where the boat was going. But the car came to a stop right at the German headquarters, where they were all hiding underneath the floor of the car. And so there's this frightening moment, which I've always perceived as incredibly dramatic, of my grandparents and the kids hiding in the car right in front of the German headquarters in Copenhagen. But the soldiers didn't stop them, and they were just allowed to continue, and they came to Sweden. And my mother's story was more a story of yes, they were going to escape. It was the night of the Jewish New Year, and they had a big goose in the oven because of Jewish New Year, and they had to escape, and they escaped to Sweden. And when they came back 3 years later, the goose was still in the oven. So my mother's mother were never able to eat goose anymore.
Well, it must have been some rotten goose when they returned.
But also, it's there's certain thing which stays, which is like mythology in your family. And this is like this sort of image of a huge, big goose being in the oven for 3 years while the family were escaping were sort of a very striking image.
Do you think that'll end up in a movie of yours sometime?
Maybe in a different shape. Right. I've kind of pretty consistently used the dramatic elements but not the autobiographical details. I kind of feel that I can't treat that material at complete liberty, which I like to do when I work, if I use the sort of concrete memories.
You're obviously interested in how people behave in war or in crisis, the things that they're capable of doing, either violent or heroic, that they didn't think they were capable of. Does that question kind of haunt you about yourself? Like, what would you do in a situation that your parents and grandparents were in, or in a situation that you've placed your characters in?
Well, it's funny because the writer Anders Thomas Jensen and I always have these discussions. It's like part of the fun we have working with one another is sort of provoking each other as to what we would have done in certain situations. Like, had you been on Titanic, what would you have done? And I think it's part of our artistic collaboration is sort of putting up those questions about one's moral habitus and then trying to address them.
So when you play that little game with each other, are you usually heroic, or do you think you'd kind of
quite often
back
not
down? Yeah.
quite. I mean, it's almost like a little bit sort of, you know, we're both a bit ashamed of realizing that probably we would not have been that heroic.
Part of In a Better World is shot in a refugee camp in Africa. I'm not sure which country it is. And you were obviously there on location. Were you actually in a refugee camp shooting?
It's shot in Kenya, and it's not exactly a refugee camp. It's a camp for people who've lost their land. So they're not refugees from some sort of atrocity, but they are people who are homeless. And it's shot in a kind of a small refugee camp that we then extended. The medical facility, which is in the movie, is something we built. And part of the extras in the film are people who are actually living in the camp, and part of the extras are people we brought in, and the people who are playing nurses are real nurses. It's a kind of mix of actors and people who are used to work in refugee camp and people who live in refugee camps.
Did you have to make tough decisions about whether to help the people who lived in this camp or just, you know, go about your business, shoot the scenes, pay the extras, and move on?
No, the elders of the camp made a very firm arrangement with the producers for us working there. And they wanted like us to build a schoolroom, and that was a deal we made with them, which was really a very healthy and sensible deal. And they were very happy about it, and we were very happy about it because it seemed very meaningful and was incredibly efficient.
So the people who built the sets for your film also built this schoolroom for the camp?
Yes, I think that some of the builders were employed by the producers and then building the other facilities that the camp had asked for.
What were some of the things you were exposed to at this camp where you were filming in Africa that surprised you and that you wouldn't have known about and that you incorporated into the film?
It's a kind of weird thing to say The strongest surprise was the climate, like the wind. The wind was crazy, and there was like the wind which was full of sand. And you can tell it in the movie because it's really beautiful, but it was almost impossible to film there. You know, we had sand coming into all the technical equipment, and it was pretty difficult to actually shoot the scenes. I think that was probably our biggest surprise, because all the other elements were something we were pretty thoroughly prepared for. And they were so nice, and they were so nice to work with. And they had a great, I mean, the like those extras that were like sitting, waiting, they had a great sense of humor. They were kind of a little bit like laughing at us because we were running around trying to get things done. And they were sitting there smiling, thinking we were a little bit nuts.
Now, the character of Big Man, who is the very sadistic warlord, he's blind in one eye. And you could see that his eye is damaged. It's very visibly damaged. Who was the person playing Big Man, and was that his real eye?
That it was his real eye. And it was this one actor came into a casting in Nairobi. It's a Kenyan actor. And I was just so fascinated by the way he looked. And I was kind of thinking, I'm going to have him play the part, even if his audition is bad, because I just think he's such a fascinating character. And then his audition were fine, so it was all right. You know, it's those rare sort of gifts you get when you are in reality of shooting, is that you get these surprises, because, you know, I don't think I would have thought of making his eye look like that, but because he came as a real thing, it that was just the way it came out.
One of the many things that your film deals with is coping with death. And without giving too much away, one character says to another character at one point, it's like there's a veil between you and death. And when someone dies, that veil temporarily slips away. And I thought that's such a good description. And I was wondering, I know you collaborated on the screenplay with Andre Thomas Jensen, whose name I hope I pronounced correctly.
Yes.
But I wonder, like, if you collaborated on that line and what that line means to you and to your experience of being close to someone who has died.
Actually, somebody told us the line, or somebody said that he had lost his brother. And he told us that that's exactly what it felt like. And we were so touched by it, and it had like an eerie accuracy. And so we thought that that would describe a very significant moment in the movie. And so we used it. I can't remember whether it was exactly like that. Anders Thomas Jensen is a great writer, so he probably rephrased it in a slightly more poetic manner. But the notion was there from somebody who had experienced it.
During part of your career as a film director, you were part of the Dogma movement, and this is a movement of filmmakers co-founded by Lars von Trier. And there was actually a manifesto of movie making, which was also known as the Vow of Chastity. So before we talk about the Vow of Chastity, when in your career were you a part of this?
I had done a few movies, and amongst all, I had done an incredibly successful romantic comedy, which was... which actually I think almost all Danes have seen. It's gone into the language of you know, kids in schoolyards are citing, still talking lines from that comedy. It's like an iconic Danish comedy. And I'd done that prior to getting involved with the Dogma movement. I think I did my Dogma film in 2001, I think. I can't remember exactly.
Well, let me
It's
read.
Open Hearts.
That was the one that became so famous?
Open Hearts was, no.
Oh,
no,
oh, Open Hearts is the Dogma one, yes.
Yes,
okay,
yes.
Okay, so let me read some of the rules from the Dogma Manifesto. Shooting must be done on location. Props and sets must not be brought in. 2, the sound must never be produced apart from the images or vice versa. 3, the camera must be handheld. 4, the film must be in color. Special lighting is not acceptable. 5, optical work and filters are forbidden. 6, the film must not contain superficial action, murders, weapons, etc. must not occur. And the rules go on. Temporal and geographical alienation are forbidden. That is to say, the film takes place here and now. Genre movies are not acceptable. And the film format must be 35 millimeter. So how did you feel after having made a successful film, having to bow to this set of rigid rules?
Well, I think...
I mean, let me put it this way. Why would you want to do that?
Because I actually believe in rules. I actually believe in artistic limitations. And I always have. I've always thought that setting out a set of rules before you start and then being completely consistent with them is the only way to make a really good film. And these particular set of rules is it's kind of they are austerity rules. They forces you to deal with the storyline and the characters, and that's it. And I thought it was a real challenge, like in a positive way. And I actually think that if you, there was a number of good films coming out from these set of rules. And I think, I mean, if I were to add something, I think those rules came at a point where European filmmaking was trying to copy American filmmaking, and you know, we didn't have the skills, we didn't have the technical skills, but even more importantly, so we did not have the financial means. So you would find that like half of a movie's budget would be spent on lighting up an entire street for one shooting. It was ridiculous, and then those rules came, and it forced the filmmakers to deal with character and storyline, and that's it. And that was very healthy and incredibly influential.
So of all the rules that I read, which were the ones that you actually found it helpful to follow?
I actually did find them all helpful to follow. I think the one which I think is the most opposed to the core nature of movie making is that the sound needs to go with the image. Because part of movie making is really that you can have a different sound over a different image. But I still thought it was really fun obeying to them.
That includes having music. You wouldn't be allowed to have a score behind it.
No, you can have music if it's in the scene. And for my
right,
if
somebody turns on the radio or is, you know, listening to their, you know, iPod or something, you have music.
Yeah, that's what I had in my film. My movie was Open Hearts, and the female main character had like an iPod with music in, and that was the music that was then used in the film.
Mm-hmm. So one more thing about this. Like when you say you did a Dogma film, does that mean that you just followed the rules or that you became an official member of the Dogma group and you met with Lars von Trier? And I mean, could I have made a Dogma film without even being in Denmark or had spoken to any of you? If I just followed the rules, could I say, this is a Dogma film?
You actually sign a document. I mean, you sign on to the Wolves of Chastity. And by the way, I am very friendly with Lars von Trier, and I do talk with him, and our kids are friends. And so, I never belonged to a group, but Denmark or the Scandinavian film community is tiny. So we all know each other, and we are sort of, for most part, friendly.
Now, I just want to read one final thing from the pledge. I swear as a director to refrain from personal taste. I am no longer an artist. I swear to refrain from creating, quote, work, unquote, as I regard the instant as more important than the whole. My supreme goal is to force the truth out of my characters and settings. So what did that mean to you, to swear to refrain from personal taste and to say I am no longer an artist?
I mean, honestly?
Yeah.
I mean, do you buy it? I mean, here's the thing. So the celebration, Festen, which is a masterpiece, is that not a piece of art? And did Thomas Vinterberg not the artist who made that movie? I mean, I think the truth about letting the movie be the character's movies works because of all the austerity within the Wars of Chastity. But there's no, even if, you know, on the Dogma film, the director's not credited. That's part of it. You're not credited. But everybody knows who does the movies anyway. And so I think it's, I think it is a genius stroke of advertising in many ways. But that, I think that's also partly what it is.
Right. Now, since you won both the Golden Globe and the Oscar for Best Foreign Film this year for In a Bitter World, you got to make two acceptance speeches, and you got to practice at the Golden Globe and then do it again at the Oscars. So what did you learn the first time around that you put into practice the second time around?
Well, I didn't, as anybody who'd seen both of them, I didn't learn that much. Here's the thing. Because you're a film director, you are not necessarily like a natural public speaker, and particularly in a situation like that, which is so emotionally loaded. So I must admit, you know, it's in both those. It's an intimidating room, and it's an overwhelming experience. And I had written for the Oscars. I had the speech in my hand, and I just knew if I was going to open the piece of paper, I would be unable to read it. So I just thought, I'm just going to say as coherently as I can whatever I can. And it's not, you know, I was incredibly grateful and happy and paralyzed, and I could not I could not have done it any different, even if I really wanted to.
So what did you say at the Oscars?
No, I guess I said that I was very happy, and I guess that I managed to thank 8% of the people that I really meant to thank, and I hope that the rest, 92%, have forgiven me because I was obviously overwhelmed.
Well, Susanna Beer, thank you so much for talking with us. Congratulations on the Oscar and the Golden Globe.
Thank you very much.
Susanna Beer's new film, In a Bitter World, begins opening in the U.S. April 1st. As a Bible scholar, ordained Baptist pastor, and professor of religion, Jennifer Canoe says she's tired of watching those who are supposed to care about the Bible reducing it to slogans. For example, she says you can't use the Bible as a straightforward guide to sexual morality because the Bible fails to offer a consistent message regarding sexual morals and God's priorities. Her new book is called Unprotected Texts, The Bible's Surprising Contradictions About Sex and Desire. Knust is an assistant professor of religion at Boston University. She's also the author of Abandoned to Lust, Sexual Slander and Ancient Christianity. Jennifer Wright Knust, welcome to Fresh Air. When it comes to marriage and the Bible is cited most often, I think it's fair to say, when it comes to gay marriage, and it's usually cited in opposition to gay marriage. But your book, mm-hmm. you know, deals with that, but it also deals with many other aspects of heterosexual marriage.
Yes.
What do you find most interesting and maybe most anachronistic mm-hmm. about what the Bible has to say about marriage?
Yeah, I think I was really careful not to address gay marriage explicitly in the book. I really didn't want the book to be about whether or not we should approve of gay marriage, because it seems to me that whatever the Bible says regarding homoerotic sexual intimacy is folded within a very large biblical conversation about sexuality in general. And so to pull out a particular verse and say, oh, well, this solves our position on, you know, gay marriage is such a mistake, given that the Bible says a lot of things about sexuality, and many of those things we would reject today. So why we're lifting out gay marriage when we've clearly rejected things like slavery and stoning women who aren't virgins at first marriage? So I, in fact, wanted to show that claims about sexuality, first of all, are entirely contradictory, and second of all, are made with many other assumptions in mind that have nothing to do with homosexuality and heterosexuality at all.
What's an example of one of the contradictory claims about sexuality?
Well, the obvious one is, you know, polygamous marriage is the assumption by many of the texts in the Hebrew Bible, and don't get married at all is the assumption of the majority of the New Testament. So that's just easy. I mean, that's just an obvious contradiction right there. Gosh, there are so many other ones.
Let me stop you. In what way does the New Testament say don't get married at all?
Well, there's a fantastic passage in Matthew in which Jesus says to his disciples that some people should be eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven. So the way this gets received by early Christians is that Jesus is recommending celibacy, which would make sense given that he says elsewhere that we shouldn't get married, that we should be focusing our attention on spreading the gospel. So the idea that be eunuch for the kingdom of heaven means be celibate would make sense. However, interestingly enough, some Christians took this literally, and there are cases of early Christians castrating themselves for the purpose of celibacy.
When Paul talks about celibacy, is he speaking to people who are disciples of Christ or who are committing to the priesthood, or is he addressing everybody?
He is addressing everybody. Paul is clearly addressing everyone because Paul clearly believes that the kingdom of heaven is going to happen in his lifetime. And so it's emergency time for him. I mean, Christ is going to return, and there is no time for marriage. We need to be celibate and be focusing on spreading the gospel. That is clearly Paul's perspective. I mean, later Christians also prefer celibacy for not only the priesthood, which there really isn't a priesthood at this point, but for not only for, so for example, male leaders, but in fact for everyone. And virginity becomes a sign of one's true devotion to Christ.
So even though the focus of your book is not gay marriage, you address it in your book. So what are some of the most frequently cited sections of the Bible used to oppose gay marriage?
Mm-hmm. Well, the two passages I hear cited most often are the commandments in Leviticus that suggest that a man may not lie with another man as with a woman, and the household codes in Ephesians. Ephesians is a New Testament letter written in the name of Paul sometime around the end of the first century. And the household codes include a description of an ideal marriage from the perspective of the author of Ephesians.
Okay, so let's start with the Old Testament then. So Leviticus, and I'm paraphrasing mm-hmm. here, says that if a man lies with another man in the manner of a woman, both of them have committed an abomination and they shall be put to death.
Yes.
So how do you interpret that? You obviously interpret that differently than people who use that to oppose gay marriage.
Well, the question I would have about Leviticus is, what is the author of Leviticus attempting to accomplish with these laws? Well, I think the answer to that question has to do with the context of Leviticus. Leviticus was written by priests, and it can be read as a critique, in part, of the Davidic monarchy. Because if we go and we read 1 and 2 Samuel, we find out that King David and his heirs violate pretty much every commandment in Leviticus. So, for example, David has an intimate relationship with the son of King Saul, whose name is Jonathan. And Jonathan loves David more than he loves women. Now, we can read that to mean that Jonathan and David had an intimate partnership in which David was the active or dominant partner in their relationship, meaning that Jonathan was David's woman, which from the perspective of 1 and 2 Samuel means that David could legitimately inherit the throne that actually belonged to Jonathan as the son of King Saul. So now Jonathan becomes one of David's wives in a way, and so therefore David can legitimately inherit. My point is that even Leviticus and 1 and 2 Samuel disagree about intimate male partnerships. So to suggest that that one commandment in Leviticus condemns gay marriage is quite a leap, especially because the Bible itself doesn't agree on this point.
But it still sounds like the bottom line is, in spite of John and David, that the Bible advises, the Old Testament advises against lying with a man in the manner of a woman.
I think one could argue that the Bible opposes homoerotic sexual encounters overall. I think that's true. But that's not the only thing that the Bible does, as the David and Jonathan example shows. And interestingly, rabbis and early Christian theologians could imagine gender much more complicated than we can. So they would imagine, for example, that they were God's wife, and they longed after God, and they longed to be welcomed by God in an erotic embrace. So I'm just trying to suggest that the story of what's in the Bible regarding homoerotic encounters is way more fascinating than a soundbite about gay marriage could possibly suggest.
Getting back to the premise of your book, which is that you can't really use the Bible as a guidebook for marriage or sexuality, what were some of the codes in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, for infidelity, for being married, for a woman getting married when she has already lost her virginity?
Okay, let's start with the first one. A woman married if she's already lost her virginity. How do we solve that problem? Well, according to the Sinai Covenant, if a woman is accused of having sex before marriage, what her family does is produce the sheets that were bloodied at her wedding night. And if the family can produce these sheets, then the man is punished by not being allowed to ever divorce his wife because he's falsely accused her of not being a virgin at marriage. If, however, the family is not able to produce the sheets, then the woman is to be stoned on her father's doorstep. The message seems to be, oh, you know, you bad Israelite father, you should have kept your daughter in line and made sure that this didn't happen. And there's all kinds of provisions in the Sinai Covenant for if a woman is, for example, raped and she's betrothed, what do you do? Well, what one can do is force her to marry her rapist and never get divorced. It's a property arrangement. Basically, if the man who does the raping has violated the property of the father, so it's up to him to pay a fine to the father and to marry the woman and therefore make her a good woman. And he's punished by the having to pay the bride price.
In the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, how accepted was polygamy? Was it assumed that all men would be polygamous? Was it just a certain class of men that was to be polygamous?
Well, it seems in Genesis, for example, that polygamy was considered normal, and it's what men did. I mean, you may remember some of the patriarchs had multiple wives and also slave wives. And I mean, the 12 sons of Jacob are fathered by multiple wives and concubines. In a subsistence economy where people are subsistence farmers, the more wives and children one has, the more prosperous one is. And that seems to be how Genesis approaches the issue. In terms of the Sinai covenant, yes, polygamy is also assumed. And The Sinai Covenant addresses the problem, for example, of a man who takes a second wife and fails to continue to support his first wife appropriately. And the covenant says, no, you have to support your first wife. You can't just stop feeding her and tending to her just because you've married a second wife. So the assumption is polygamy, and the kings also have many, many wives, which again seems to be a sign of their prosperity and wealth. How many wives can you have? How many children can you have? This shows how fancy and wealthy you are. By the time you get to the New Testament, Jews have already stopped practicing polygamy largely. They're usually just having one wife at that point. There is an interesting marriage contract from the first century that suggests the polygamy is still happening in Judea at that time, but it's unusual. So it kind of goes out of fashion as just history goes forward, culture changes, prosperity and notions of prosperity change.
So we've heard you talk about what you have chosen to ignore in the Bible, things about polygamy, slavery, stoning to death somebody who wasn't a virgin when she got married, those kinds of things, and things that you're interpreting differently than people who oppose gay marriage and interpret. Mm-hmm. So given that you've thrown out a lot, you're interpreting things differently than a lot of other people, what do you find in the Bible that you love? In other words, if you're challenging a lot of the things that are in the Bible, why does it remain such an important book to you? Why are you a pastor? If do you know why are you a religion scholar? If mm-hmm. if there's so much that you think is wrong, like slavery, polygamy, stoning women to death.
You know, I tell a story in the introduction to my book about growing up with the Bible and with my mom. My mom used to read the Bible to me before school when I was a little girl. We'd sit on a big couch and we had a big picture Bible and we read every story in the Bible. I mean, we really did. I was so prepared for seminary. I knew all the Bible thanks to my mom. So, and what I remember about that is how invitational that was and how friendly it was and how warm it was. We would sit together and we would come up with troubling questions. We would encounter troubling stories and we would talk about them. And in the process of that conversation, we would think about how God loves us. We would think about how we love one another. And we would think about how we want to be to one another and to the people in our own communities. You know, when I go to church on Sunday, when I teach the little kids Sunday school, which I do, I try to keep that lesson in mind. And therefore, the Bible remains infinitely fascinating and infinitely love-giving and inspiring to me because I read it as a document produced by human beings who love God and who are doing the best they can. I'm a person who also loves God and is doing the best she can, as are the people at my church, as are the little kids that I work with, as are my seminary students, as are my college students. We're all doing the best we can here. And to read the Bible as a kind of invitation to thinking about what it means to be human and what it means to love God means that the Bible remains at the center of my reflection in a positive way.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me. It's been a great privilege and an honor to speak with you, Terry.
Jennifer Knust is the author of the new book, Unprotected Texts, The Bible's Surprising Contradictions About Sex and Desire. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross. One more thing before I go. Yesterday on the show, I was telling singer Jimmy Dale Gilmore that his voice reminded me of Gene Autry's. We didn't have time to play any of Autry's recordings yesterday, so we'll close with one today. This is the title song from his 1940 singing cowboy film, Melody Ranch, which co-starred Ann Miller.
Stake your claim on Melody Ranch with a song. As you ride neath the moon side by side, let a tune be your guide. Stake your claim on Melody Ranch with a song. Harmonize, learn the words, vocalize with the birds in the skies. You'll find your love, and when you're beneath its spell, from up above, the moonbeams will wish you well. Round the flame on Melody Ranch you belong. With a song in your heart, come along, be a part of the throng. And stake your claim on Melody Ranch.